blog that served up his acumen as a financial industry analyst. He shared articles about stocks and finance and the economy. Traffic was meager. Then, about a year in, he took a different take. I started being honest about my fears, my concerns, my worries, my failures in the past. And I've had some enormous failures. And traffic on my blog probably went up. I'm not even exaggerating, 20,000%, just by being honest. Everyday people call me with opportunities, he says. Some of Altucher's most popular posts, I want my kids to be drug addicts, about having passion. Three stories about billionaires, about money and happiness. I'm completely humiliated by yoga, about attending a yoga retreat with his yogini wife. And how to be an effective loser, about being thrown out of grad school. You don't have to go the shock and awe route to build yourself a trusting audience. But you do need to find your own version of authentic, value-based content that is uniquely you and infused with GVAC, my shorthand for those critical traits, generosity, vulnerability, accountability, and candor. Too many people mistakenly think that broadcasting their successes is the only or best way to establish credibility. Altucher says they're afraid. You feel like if I tell people I lost money or I lost my wife or I was crying on this one particular day during the financial crisis, then people are no longer going to respect me. They no longer are going to want to do business with me. Not at all true, he says, because ultimately it's your humanity that makes people care to listen. And it's your admission that you too are human that makes them trust you about everything else. So much of your competition is dishonest most of the time. This does not necessarily mean that they're lying. It just means that their boundaries are tight, says Altucher. If you go beyond those boundaries and are truly honest with your colleagues and your competitors and your potential customers, then you suddenly rise above the competition. Everybody knows this is you. In analog human relations, fear creates risk avoidance, which means the avoidance of putting yourself out there to give generously, to be candid, to show accountability, to come face to face with another person, to give of yourself in whatever measure to him or her, and so to run the risk of rejection. Online, good content has the same risks, embarrassment, rejection, etc., but also the same potential rewards, connection, laughter, even love. Your challenge is to fearlessly put it out there. Here are a few insights on how to infuse your content with those qualities that make human connection flourish. Generosity. Generosity online is the willingness to give and to receive. It's also a generosity of spirit, being willing to show up, listen, and share your best ideas. Generosity, as always, is a great way to transition someone from indifference to interest. Join conversations before you start them. When Gary Vaynerchuk, the now famous social media guru behind WineLibrary.tv, first decided he was going to take to Twitter to promote his family's wine shop, he didn't sign up and start screaming with 10 tweets a day about how great his Chardonnays were. Instead, he hunted down ongoing conversations about wine and joined in. He shared his enthusiasm with other wine nuts like me, was helpful where he could be, and learned a lot about what people already tweeting about wine cared about. In this way, he attracted followers who were then thrilled to click on the links to his videos. The videos themselves exuded Gary's unpretentious, effervescent personality. Here was a guy who was fun to watch and doing his own thing. A multi-million dollar business and several best-selling books later, Gary is still that guy. Although he's talking more often about social media these days than wine. I hope he's still drinking it. Speak in a language that matters. Attention is the scarce resource we all compete for these days. As the stream scrolls by, we have an eye blink of time to encourage someone to click us instead of the many other links before and after ours. The clarity, efficiency, and effectiveness with which you communicate who you are and why it's relevant is the linchpin for expanding your recognition, increasing your influence, and attracting attention. Great ideas, a great product, it's not enough. Take the dieting book, The Moderate Carbohydrate Diet. Ever hear of it? Probably not. Despite its good ideas, at least as far as the dieting genre goes, the book was published with a thud. Repackaged as the South Beach Diet, the book became a cultural phenomenon. The messages you send out into the world need to be in language that matters. Tell people how you're solving a problem they already know they have. Putting yourself in your reader's shoes and responding to their needs is generous, and it will also get you read. Every headline is a pitch. Again, if you believe your content has value for people, and that should be your first rule of content, generosity means thinking carefully about how to make that value immediately clear. Otherwise, people will pass it by. Think about email. When you send a message, you know how important it is to you. But to the person on the other end, it's just one of dozens he or she has received that day with nothing to distinguish it. Except one thing, if you do it right. The subject line. Dan Pink, in his book To Sell Is Human, tells us that the best subject lines tease one of two human needs, utility or curiosity. Either they clearly state the usefulness, how to fine-tune your email subject lines and get read, or they set up an intriguing mystery that clicking will solve. You won't believe what I did to get my email read. And by the way, always make sure that your piece pays off the promise of the headline. There's nothing generous about a bait and switch. Give your tweets legs. Facebook's prompt in the status update window used to be, "What are you doing right now?" I always thought that was terrible. What a great way to encourage boring messages. I'm at the dog park. I'm eating grilled cheese. I'm watching Law and Order. The useless dreck of social media. Even if we're friends, that's content that falls with a thud. Dan Pink calls these "Me Now" tweets and says they're among the three poorest ranking tweet types, alongside personal gripes, "My boss is being a jerk," and pleasantries, "Hello, world." The better prompt would be this: "What's got your attention?" There's a subtle utility in that shift, and once you make it, you'll start seeing your content get shared and commented on. So you're not posting "at the movies." You're posting, "I saw the new Will Ferrell movie. It was hilarious. Must see." Now you're giving people something useful, a value judgment. Even better is when you can also provide them with a link if they want to go deeper. Give them an article, a film trailer, a restaurant review, something that allows for more communication than 140 characters, introduces them to something new, and gives them an action. Today, Facebook's prompt has become, "What's on your mind?" A big step, no doubt data-driven, in the right direction. Still, I like mine better. What's got your attention? Go ahead. Tweet something now. Whenever possible, co-create. Keith, I want a blog, but I don't know what I'd write about. If you think that the creative process begins with you, a blank screen and a deep cup of coffee, you're making things very hard on yourself. The best ideas come from looking around you and constantly asking, "How can I be helpful to people?" And then engaging them early and often in the process of creation. Take the popular podcast Grammar Girl, the creator of which, Mignon Fogarty, I've featured in the past in my newsletter. Mignon was working as a copy editor and saw the same errors over and over. Her co-workers, like so many of us, had never been taught basic rules of grammar. She saw a need, and she went with it, recording her first three podcasts in a week, quickly moving to a format where a fan provides the question. Within months of its July 2006 launch, the Grammar Girl podcast was the most popular educational download on iTunes. Inviting others to co-create gives them an opportunity to be part of something, a community effort. You'd be surprised how satisfying that is. In fact, I think it's half the reason that crowdsourcing platforms like Kickstarter have been so successful. On top of that, co-creation increases the likelihood that the end product is going to be something your audience is interested in. After all, they help create it. I just got an email in my box today from a guy who's writing a curriculum to help authors market their books. He's starting the process by asking his audience what they want. Help writing? Help marketing? Help selling? Sure, it's a survey, but his track record, created through his content and follow-through over time, tells me that he'll really use the input to make the thing great. He's going to decide what to write about based on what I say? Sure, I'll answer, and I'll buy it, too. One thing to remember when it comes to co-creation, never is it more important that you follow through. You can't engage people's efforts and passion and then spit the bit. Vulnerability. Being brave enough to be vulnerable in person is hard enough, but at least if you make an ass of yourself, the moment is over quickly. Making yourself vulnerable online feels even more risky. Don't let that put you off. Think of it this way. The last thing you want to be in a competitive marketplace is replaceable. You want to be uniquely you, by definition, irreplaceable. And the only way to do that is to risk putting yourself out there. Try cross-dressing. One easy way to explore vulnerability is to blend your personal and professional messaging. Most people use Facebook for friends and LinkedIn for professional contacts and don't mix the two much. While I'm not a fan of that strict separation, even if that approach makes sense for you, you can still mix up the messaging. Why wouldn't family and friends want to know what's going on for you at work, so long as you make it interesting? Personal contacts are a perfectly good source of professional advice, support, and even opportunities. Blend anecdotes with utility. You can blend in the personal and still provide useful information. Penelope Trunk, the wildly popular blogger, entrepreneur, and author of Brazen Careerist, often comments in her posts that her editor, note engaging an editor, not a bad idea, won't let her publish anything that doesn't have utility for her core audience, people trying to improve their careers. She may write 500 words about homeschooling her kids or the pigs on her husband's farm, but it will ultimately have a useful nugget about how to improve your productivity or find a better job. Go public with failure. Being open about the fact that you've made mistakes tells people that you've got nothing to hide. Aside from that, if we would all just own up to our failures, we could stop perpetuating the crippling illusion that the ultra-successful get that way by succeeding over and over again. No, they get that way by failing over and over again in increasingly ambitious experiments until they succeed and succeed big. So be brave enough to put it all out there, the stuff that worked and the stuff that didn't, with your insights on why and how to fix it next time. And watch as people snap to attention. They'll trust you because of your experience and your honesty. Mug for the camera. Unless you're Charles Dickens, it's a lot easier to give people an authentic snapshot of who you are and what you care about with a camera than with prose. Go scroll through your newsfeed and you'll quickly see that posts with photos are the ones that catch your eye and pack an emotional punch. When it comes to photos of you, there's nothing wrong with a little vanity. Remember, I live in LA. I'm not immune. To guide what you allow on your wall and what you delete. But don't be such an overzealous untagger that every image of you that can be found anywhere is exactly the same pose, with the same camera face expression. Put some thought into your profile photos, by far the most desirable real estate on your page. Do you need a professional headshot? If you can afford a good photographer, go for it. If not, don't sweat it. The most successful LinkedIn photo is a crisp, vivid shot of your head and shoulders that conveys life and energy. Ask friends to weigh in. We don't always recognize the perfect photo when we see it. One guy I know is a respected literary agent and a wonderful father who's worked hard to make sure he can be great at both. For a while, if you went to his LinkedIn page, you'd find a photo of him skiing with his son. When you click through page after page of headshots on LinkedIn and then suddenly stumble on one that gives a glimpse of the life behind the resume, it really has an impact. Meanwhile, in my agent friend's case, the content of his profile more than established his professional credibility. Obviously, your industry and work culture impact what you can get away with. Craig, a funny guy who used to run FG's Tech, to this day has as his profile picture on LinkedIn a shot of himself in dark sunglasses, hunched over in a chair, playing a guitar and a harmonica at the same time. And now he works at the United Nations. Fortunately for Craig, tech geeks are those rare creatures who all seem to celebrate nonconformity at work and everywhere else. Take a look at the pictures of people working in the field you're working in, or want to be working in. Take a temperature check on the spectrum of normal, and then find a classy, idiosyncratic way to push it. By the way, Craig may have been a bit out there, but he was probably the most well-liked employee we've ever had at the company. Accountability. Accountability is about more than living up to promises and holding others to the same. It's also about taking up a bold position and staying the course in the face of criticism or fear. Take away accountability, and generosity, candor, and vulnerability lose their potency fast. But what does it mean to be accountable when it comes to your content? Become your own editor-in-chief. Consistency helps readers engage. That's why you should think like an editor when feeding your online outposts. Create an editorial schedule of what kind of content you'll post and when. And you'll quickly find that providing some structure to your efforts makes it a lot easier to be accountable to your plans to communicate through social media. Also try to create your own shtick for lack of a better word, a content brand defined by that thing you do that no one else does. For example, there's a guy named Noah Scalin whose project was to make a skull a day and post pictures of them all at skulladay.blogpost.com. He committed to doing it for a full year. I started by making an orange paper skull on June 4th, 2007, and posting it online saying, "I'm making a skull a day for a year," he wrote on his blog. I made my 365th skull on June 2nd, 2008, and even posted a bonus skull the day after, since it was a leap year. Scalin's work may sound creepy, or it may sound creative, depending on your taste. Whatever you think of it, the project grew into two published books and attracted a huge number of loyal fans, among whom are many potential clients for his socially conscious design and consulting firm, Another Limited Rebellion. More standard approaches include weekly, monthly, or quarterly newsletters, using Friday as a day to call out people you like on Twitter, or annual top 10 lists, the contents of which are defined entirely by your passion. Keep yourselves in sync. Online is a terrific space for exploration, experimentation, and even aspiration. As Chris Brogan once said to me, try writing your LinkedIn profile for the job you want to have, not the job you have. But the creative freedom in this world, where image and identity seem so pliable, can also lead to confusion and to missteps. If you'd been a member of my newsletter list in 2010, you would have woken up one day to an email with this subject line: 6 things you could learn from my marketing debacle. At the time, I was in the midst of one of my own digital experiments, an online learning program called the Relationship Masters Academy, that later became My Greenlight. Today, all the learnings from that program have been processed and reborn in an app I'm super excited about, Expert Habits. This was exciting new territory for me, a new extension of my brand and a new business model, a consumer product. Until then, my business was entirely in consulting and speaking. We had worked hard on the program, and when it came time to sell it online, we felt like we needed some help. We turned to a couple of guys who were well-regarded in the online information marketing community, and they set to work to create a campaign that included a series of emails that they'd send to both their own extensive email list and to mine. When my team saw the emails they drafted, they knew they were way out of sync with the Keith my newsletter fans were accustomed to, which was pretty much seamless with the Keith you'd meet in person. I also had never made a hard sell to them other than promoting the occasional book. The newsletter was all about generosity, giving back to the fans who bought my book and came to my events by giving them tips and updates on my work. So we pushed back, asking for changes. But these super smart marketing guys told us that we didn't get it. The emails were designed and tested and had a carefully calibrated psychology to them. Changes would lead to fewer sales, they told us. And so we sent them as they were, more or less. We didn't want our campaign to fail, after all. Afterward, we got some complaints and negative feedback, but the whole thing seemed more or less to blow over. Then one day I was speaking at an event. 2 fans came up to me afterward and shared their personal concern, and I could tell disappointment over the emails. One lady said that Who's Got Your Back had saved her life, and she felt she had to come and see me in person to understand what was the truth. Was I the guy who showed people how to let their guard down and let people in, or the pushy salesman in those Crazy Eddie-style act-now-or-else emails? Ouch. Trust me, this was not a comfortable moment. Ultimately, you have to remember that this projection, this collection of bits and bytes, isn't separate from you. It is you, as far as the world is concerned. So your experimentation, exploring a particular aspect of your personality or a new passion, should never get too far afield from how you're willing to represent yourself in the flesh. Likewise, when life's curveballs fundamentally change who you are, sometimes you need to actively reshape the online record, updating profiles and about pages, sending messages to followers to bring the two back into sync. What's at risk is your integrity. Once you've projected yourself into a public space, digital or real, and especially if you've emerged as a leader, people become invested in the you they know from all your prior content. You have to be accountable to that. And when it changes, and of course it will, gently and respectfully bring them up to speed. A few points to consider when it comes to identity accountability. A new business, a new channel, or new advisors can't mean new values. The older I get and the more success I have experienced, I fully believe that we win when we authentically believe in what we are selling, products, ideas, and represent ourselves in a way that we're proud of. That said, the tough thing about authenticity is that it demands you know who you are and what you care about, and that you do your best to be true to that. It certainly requires a good deal of introspection to have that clarity, especially given that who we are is fluid. Time changes us. But you can't let your actions be determined by convenience or popular opinion. And you're much more likely to be led inappropriately if you aren't constantly checking in with yourself and your beliefs. There are no excuses. As my wrestling coach, Mr. Brown, used to say, there are two types of people in this world, those who make excuses and those who get the job done. No excuses. You are 100% responsible for anything that has your name on it. Make the rules of your relationship clear and stick to the rules always. The father of permission-based marketing, Seth Godin, told me years ago that I was doing a disservice not to give more back to my readership. I really tried to follow that advice, which I think was encapsulated well in this blog post of his. In order to get permission to market to someone, you make a promise. You can promise a newsletter and talk to me for years. You can promise a daily RSS feed and talk to me every 3 minutes. You can promise a sales pitch every day, but the promise is the promise until both sides agree to change it. You don't assume that just because you're running for president or coming to the end of the quarter or launching a new product that you have the right to break the deal. You don't. When you mess up, come clean. Why do so many people double down when they're caught in a mistake? Instead, accept responsibility, ask for help, and take steps to correct your course. Candor. Authenticity, the unvarnished presentation of truth, is not only scarce, it's supremely valuable. It's the alpha, the omega, the essence of leadership, sales, marketing, pretty much any discipline involved in motivating humans to do anything. Candor isn't just about saying what's true, but doing so as a matter of habit in the risky, fluid moment that your opinion can have the most impact. Say what no one else will. Those magical moments when people are publicly, brazenly candid ring out like a shot. In screenwriter Josh Olson's case, candor created something more like an atomic explosion. Olson published a piece in the Village Voice called "I Will Not Read Your Blank Script." I took out the expletive here. The essay was a rant he had written in an afternoon after a friend of a friend asked him to read a script synopsis and then got PO'd when he didn't like it. In a few thousand painfully honest words, Olson gave voice to a sentiment that everyone else in Hollywood, a town not known for its candor, had painfully, politely suppressed. Grateful emails poured into his inbox. People wanted to meet with him, work with him, read other things he wrote. Sure, he got plenty of flack, too. But ultimately, the essay got him more meetings with more important people than the screenplay that got him an Academy Award nomination. People are desperate for authenticity. Everywhere you look today, there's someone lying about something, some organization glossing over the truth, some person not telling it like it is. There is a scarcity of the authentic in our culture. So many people are liars. They lie to themselves. They lie to their friends. They lie to their lovers, clients, customers, colleagues. That if you become the one in a thousand that is truly honest, then you will stand out, writes Altucher. And when you stand out, you will find success. You will find money. You will find happiness. You will find health. When you make honesty a habit, controversy is never far away. But for every person someone like Altucher or Olson has alienated, 10 more are drawn in. Magnetism isn't the only value of honesty. The level of transparency these guys are bringing to their endeavors ensures they're always receiving a healthy level of feedback. Create virtual immediacy. I was once at a very buttoned-up event where a woman on a panel was participating via video conference from a home office due to a canceled flight. We hit that point late in the session when people's attention inevitably starts to wander. I was close to nodding off. Then, wham! This woman's cat jumped onto her desk and stuck his face in front of the webcam. She didn't miss a beat. She briefly introduced him, threw him over her shoulder, then returned to her discussion about social media for large corporations. You could feel the crowd wake up, lean in, and reconnect immediately. People were finally listening. A little spontaneity goes a long way. Of course, the ability to be spontaneous and relaxed while on a webcam might not come naturally at first, so create opportunities to practice. Video conferencing or virtual chatting with family and friends is a good place to start. When it comes to creating candid content, pick a medium that suits your strengths. James Altucher holds Twitter Q&As, where people can show up and ask him whatever they want. Questions ranging from how do I raise financing for my company to how do I find love. When I do my Google Hangout interviews, instead of propping a green screen behind me to pretend I'm in a studio, I like to host them in our office's central conference room. Employees gather, and when I can, I pull them into the conversation. Grope. Fail. Adapt. Repeat. The most successful entrepreneurs make their best moves by experimentation, trial and error, opportunism, and, quite literally, accident. Altucher is constantly laying the seeds for self-renewal. He sends out ideas, then sees what comes back, who is attracted to them, and why. And from the response, he creates new connections and opportunities. He evolves. Sometimes we think that all we should be trumpeting are the huge milestones, the grand, I have finished something genius, get ready, announcements. Status updates and blogs make it easy to drop short updates along the way that take people on your ride. When did something go wrong? When did you have a small win? What could you use some advice on? So share your process, grope, fail, adapt, repeat. and do it all with the attention and the guidance of those who care enough to follow along. Chapter 24. Engineering Serendipity. John Perry Barlow said, "They used to say fortune prefers the prepared mind. Now it's fortune prefers the networked mind." We've covered the fringe and how to interact with it through content to develop a large, trusting network with you at the center, constantly receiving useful information from people you've identified as connected to your goals, interests, and professional gambits. This chapter deals with a more elusive challenge. Meeting and connecting with the people whom you don't know you need to know. Maybe you've heard the Isaac Asimov quote, "The most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not eureka, but that's funny." Asimov's point is that the best insights are generated from surprising, unexpected connections that became something more. Happy accidents. Life-changing moments we couldn't plan for and never expected. Information we couldn't Google because we didn't even know what to ask. Serendipity is today's buzzword for these seemingly magical moments, and it's shaping up to be one of the most important drivers of 21st century business success. For much of the last 150 years of economic history, the smartest people gravitated to where the money was. The money today is looking for where the smartest people are. To stay relevant amid constant technological disruption, every venture of any size is looking for creativity. Because wherever you find creativity, and by extension, wherever you find talent, innovation and profits soon follow. These days, the challenge of companies isn't to scale efficiency, but to scale learning, our ability to master and remaster new rules of business as they explode around us. Today's employees need to become whizzes when it comes to identifying, developing, and integrating the new and the better. How to get lucky. Looking at successful, well-connected entrepreneurs from afar, hearing in broad strokes about their unlikely but fortuitous social encounters that become career-transforming moments, bumping into ex-chief executive officer, or befriending Y future software genius, leading to Z remarkable adventure, the typical reaction is, WTF? Why do some people have all the luck? It's when you get up close that you can see an underlying design that actively and repeatedly creates these lucky social situations. One thing these people all have in common is the ability to engineer serendipity. The success story of Heidi Roizen, from thankless newsletter editor to one of Silicon Valley's best-connected venture capitalists, epitomizes this kind of carefully orchestrated luck. The apparent serendipity of this transformation can be mapped back to specific interrelated milestones. Today, Roizen is an incredibly desirable and successful VC, largely because she's tech-savvy and incredibly well-connected. One of the few people who can pick up the phone and ask Bill Gates for a favor, because she focused on networking, or as she puts it, building a social framework early in her career by becoming active in trade associations and philanthropic projects, because she realized early on that context creates intent, as she puts it, and the best relationships would be forged working on projects of mutual passion with others. She became such a proactive networker because, at 23, she had just become the CEO of a startup software company. She knew she would need excellent relationships to overcome the fact that the company was a little fish in a big pond. because... The opportunity was dropped into her lap by her brother, who had written a Mac software program in Virginia and didn't have the business background to sell it and grow the company. As a fresh MBA grad, the opportunity was perfect for Roizen, who didn't want any of the three typical career paths of MBAs at the time: venture capitalist, investment banker, or management consultant. Because, for heaven's sakes, she had been an English major before shifting gears to technology and business. She only went to biz school because her first post-college job was at Tandem Computers, editing the company newsletter. The position turned her on to technology, but served up long hours and no pay. She saw that it was the engineers and business students who were driving the Ferraris, so she decided to go the MBA route, but applied only to Stanford, because the Palo Alto area was where her life and her network were, as well as the burgeoning Silicon Valley business community. This put her in the perfect geography to run with the CEO position when it came her way. Roizen ultimately grew the business into a thriving software company and sold it for big bucks. Not too bad for a self-admitted average student. What's at work here? Roizen shaped her own serendipity by being open to opportunities delivered by chance. Creating a network so broad that it was an incubator of the unexpected. Planting herself firmly at the geographic center of the technology community. Becoming a highly visible leader in associations and philanthropic organizations, giving rise to the kinds of situations where the most fruitful, generous relationships are born, where information flows free, and people trust one another enough to help one another. The idea that you can and should hack serendipity is a central theme of the book The Power of Pull by John Hagel, John Seely Brown, and Lang Davison. Their work has profoundly influenced how I schedule my life and has given rise to many of the ideas in this chapter. Roizen's story reads like a page from their playbook. The book describes the new world in which the merging of globalization and digital technology has unleashed a boundless, constant, and accessible flow of ideas, capital, talent, and opportunity. Tapping that flow, they argue, is the key to both organizational and individual productivity, growth, and prosperity. Here's the problem. More so than at any other time, change is the constant. Globalization means more competition. Technology means the thing that makes you better than the competition today is obsolete tomorrow. In such an environment, anything you know at any point in time is depreciating at an accelerating rate. It's not what you know. It's how quickly you're able to know the new and right things. Master the art of serendipity, and you'll open crucial channels to rich flows of knowledge and opportunities. Your first step is to constantly ask yourself, how can I foster juxtapositions of really smart people who would normally never have the opportunity to talk to one another, but if they did, would create amazing value? Now, some more specific hacks to create the kind of network that promotes such happy accidents. Be where it's at. When you use social media and elbow grease to maintain a massive fringe network, it becomes a serendipity engine on its own. You'll know you're getting there when your news feeds and email inbox are frequently delivering conversations or new contact requests from people whom you don't know well, but with whom you share something remarkable, a common interest, a complementary capability, and so on. But our virtual lives aren't the only story. Don't discount the value of true physical proximity in making your own luck. If you need proof that geography still matters, look no farther than Silicon Valley, where people pay obscene premiums for real estate and rent, so that they can live and work in close proximity to their tech brethren. Researchers call these talent hubs spikes, and they keep happening even though technology has made it possible to have employees all over the world. People correctly sense that being in the thick of it pays off in the way of more opportunity. Why does every screenwriter in Los Angeles carry around a copy of his latest work? In case Steven Spielberg is in line behind him in the coffee bean, of course. Let diversity find you. There's another benefit to incidental encounters. They inject diversity into the system. The best part of being an entrepreneur and author is that I get to travel a lot. And the best thing about that travel is that it puts me in touch with an endless stream of new people from all walks of life and parts of the globe. That's not the situation for most people. Where I live in LA, for example, people generally go by car from familiar place to familiar place. Except for the screenwriters, who are all at the coffee shop. The result is that unless you make a real effort, you get into a social groove and see the same people over and over. New Yorkers are completely different. Every day they find themselves interacting with dozens of new people, none of whom are shy about offering their unique point of view, sometimes with a few expletives attached. A recent study at MIT showed that productivity and innovation in urban areas track with population growth. As scientist Wei Pan told the Smithsonian magazine, "What really happens when you move to a big city is you get to know a lot of different people, although they are not necessarily your friends. These are the people who bring different ideas, bring different opportunities and meetings with other great people that may help you." E.B. White, it turns out, was even more accurate than he knew when he wrote, "No one should come to New York unless he is willing to be lucky." If, like many people, you're not in a position to uproot yourself to a city that never sleeps, travel is an incredible way to open yourself to new experiences and insights. I always notice that I have a burst of creativity when I get back from my trips to Guatemala, where I spend some time working directly with village kids and sometime powwowing with local entrepreneurs, officials, and local activists. I come home with 15 new ideas, which I throw at my staff in rapid fire and let them parry back until one or two ultimately stick and a new solution is born. Consider spending time in other cities or even other countries as an investment in your career. Attend conferences, which are terrific for serendipity, not only because they bring together diverse groups of people around a similar interest, but also because all those people are there for the same reason: to meet new people and learn new things. They are in a mindset that invites serendipity. Create a force field. Speaking of conferences, you surely know people who go to them and come back brimming with stories about all the interesting people they met and buddied up with. And then you know others who hoist a sad business card or two onto their desks and complain the whole thing was a waste and the lectures were boring. Being in a spike isn't enough on its own. You've got to take advantage of the opportunity consciously, with a little bit of push and a little bit of pull. Consider putting location-based social media on the serendipity beat. I've had more than one spontaneous meeting because I tweeted my location and someone said, "Hey, I'm 3 blocks away. Let's have coffee." I'm often asked to advise new social technology startups, and the power of companies like Foursquare and HereOnBiz to create this kind of unplanned interaction is clear. Make an effort to frequent not just any spaces, but the ones where people are open to interacting. Bars, coffee shops, and the other third spaces, where people look for community outside of their family or office. You've got to exhibit body language that says, "Talk to me." That means ungluing your eyeballs and your thumbs from your iPhone. Your goal as you move through the world should be to create a force field inside of which people feel safe to play by different rules. Model the traits that support serendipity: curiosity, generosity, passion, and humility. Create social opportunities, like the dinners I described earlier, that allow others to build trust. In companies, CEOs almost invariably set the tone and the rituals of their company cultures. If the leader is candid and generous, so too are employees down the chain. You see the same cascade with negative behaviors, unfortunately. It's uncanny. Likewise, when you host an event, if you model the level of intimacy and trust you'd like to see, it will quickly be reflected back at you. Guests open up and say things that they might otherwise have held back. And aha! Suddenly we see serendipity in language and information. New channels of conversation, even among people who interact with each other all the time. All you need to get the ball rolling is a little chutzpah, and if that fails, a little wine. Passion is a possibility engine. This book has an entire chapter devoted to passion, that magic potion for connecting rapidly with others. But passion has become even more important since the first edition. Passion generates energy, which makes it easier to reach out with the kind of volume and enthusiasm required to build a serendipity-generating network, and then have those productive interactions that lead to gold. Passion drives engagement, choosing to participate in every way you can think of. Acting on an idea, whether it's as small as writing a blog or as big as creating a business, sends a shockwave out into the world that flows back even stronger as others gain interest in your ideas and wish to add their own and participate. Putting something out there in the form of content on the web, a live presentation, a book, your imagination is the only limit, creates a force of attraction, a unique and new community all gathered around you, energized by your shared interest. Remember, your ideas don't have to be perfectly refined to reel in fellow enthusiasts. All you have to do is engage people, and chances are those people will have questions and answers that you could never have imagined, pushing you further. If your passion fires are burning low, stoke them with novelty. I know one high-powered management consultant who enrolled in an 8-week ice hockey class just for the sake of trying something completely new. The classes were a refreshing mental wake-up, and she met new people, some of whom became friends. Operational mindset. Optimism. One of our recent summer interns, John, an ambitious kid from Malaysia, was having a tough time getting a job at a company that would sponsor his visa. When the company he regarded as his last chance fell through, he was devastated, certain he was going to have to go home at the end of the summer. He decided to make the best of one of his last weekends in town by taking a spontaneous trip to Chicago with a friend. While walking the city streets, he ran into an old school acquaintance who worked at a management consulting company there in Chicago. The guy got him an interview, and 2 weeks later he had his dream job and an apartment overlooking Lake Michigan. John engineered his own luck by stepping on that plane. He took himself off the carefully planned path that was hitting a dead end. Anyone who wants to achieve something extraordinary needs a plan. Most of you reading this book are planners. It's okay, I'm a planner too. But in the words of Joichi Ito, director of MIT's Media Lab, if you plan your whole life, by definition you can't get lucky. So you have to leave that little slot open. Creating space for serendipity requires conscious effort. Consider what Google, a company that's become synonymous with innovation, did to maximize the possibility of serendipitous exchanges between employees. The buildings are shaped like bent rectangles, a design that was intended to increase casual collisions among employees, the company's real estate chief told the New York Times. Rooftop cafes encourage employees to hang out away from their desks, and every employee's desk is no more than a 2.5-minute walk away from all the others. You may not be able to rearrange your office floor plan, but you can similarly design your own life to maximize serendipity with a little awareness. You'll have to leave time on your schedule for things that in the moment may seem so far removed from your immediate goals that they seem silly. A trip to the park, coffee with an old classmate, going left when you would normally go right. Say yes to new experiences when you would normally say no. The key is in adopting the attitude that this effort isn't a distraction or even a diversion, but is in fact contingent on your success. In the book, Heart, Smarts, Guts, and Luck, my old friend Tony Chan and his co-authors studied people they called luck dominant and found that 86% of them credited their success to being open to new things and people. By now, I hope you're convinced that you need a relationship action plan. But if every single person you're meeting is on it, you're missing the broader message. Going out into the world and connecting is as much about shifting your focus to others as it is about achieving your own agenda. I've heard of one startup CEO who considers manufacturing serendipity by networking and being generous to the people he meets to be 30% of his job description. The future is dynamic and not fully in your control. Celebrate that fact instead of fighting it, and life gets a lot more interesting. Keep your eyes open, be humble and generous, and save time and attention for the spontaneous, the quirky, and the left field. Make it better by learning and doing. You've connected to the fringe. Ideas are flowing in. Content infused with your humanity and that special sauce of serendipity is flowing out. So now what? Without action, it's all just blabber, right? So get busy. Take all your new contacts, all that data, and take action. Establish communities of passion and create opportunities for collaboration. Gather up all those smart people in a process of simultaneous learning and doing. Create or join projects that involve important segments of your network. And put the right people in the right context to have the right conversations in the service of actually making or doing something relevant to your goals. And also to theirs. I have a friend, Gina Rudan, a sharp, vivacious leadership coach. When I first met Gina, she had a successful coaching practice just 1 year out of the gate and was busy at work on getting liftoff around her new goal, to write and publish a book. Our meeting was no accident. I was on a list of 15 authors whose books had helped her move from vision to venture. She had become an active, visible member of my online community. So I invited her to participate in a 2-day workshop that I was doing in New York, thereby putting her in exactly the right place for a very happy accident. As part of the workshop, she was randomly partnered in a lifeline group, a butt-kicking, supportive accountability circle, with my co-author and longtime colleague and friend, Tal Raz. There was no one better person for her to have met. Tal was able to offer invaluable counsel and feedback that helped her envision the path from idea to getting published. And the atmosphere of the entire event was optimized to maximize serendipity, since everyone there was there because they believed business relationships should be generous and supportive. They were there to engage, listen, and leave richer than they arrived. Gina was hard at work creating this kind of serendipity in multiple areas of her life. She was smart enough to know that to become a published author, there were many questions she didn't know the answer to, and even more that she didn't even know yet to ask. So she